WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the new book, My Mentor, Alec Wilkinson writes about his relationship with his mentor, William Maxwell. Maxwell was a much-loved, although not widely known, writer and editor. He died in 2000 at the age of 91. Maxwell was the author of several novels and short story collections. From 1936 to 75, he was a fiction editor at The New Yorker, where he worked with such writers as John Updike, John Cheever, Vladimir Nabokov, J.D. Salinger, and Mary McCarthy. Updike described Maxwell's voice as one of the wisest in American fiction, as well as one of the kindest. Maxwell was born in the small town of Lincoln, Illinois, where he lived until moving to Chicago at the age of 14. Much of his fiction was set in the past, in towns like Lincoln. In a few minutes, we'll talk about Maxwell with Alec Wilkinson, author of My Mentor. First, we have an interview with William Maxwell, recorded after the publication of his book All the Days and Nights in 1995, the year he won the gold medal for fiction from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. A lot of the stories in your new collection come out of memories of your childhood. How much do you feel that your memory of your past has been your subject as a writer?
I think about three quarters of the time, actually. When I was first beginning to write, I wrote largely out of the present. And was alert for any situation taking place around me that could make a story. But the present, though very pleasant, didn't seem to go very deeply into anything. And memories sit on the back of the stove like soup, and they get richer and richer from the things they attract to them, and their wonderful kind of accidental quality. But I also have a kind of abnormal memory, really. My memories go back, as far as I can make out, to when I was 2 years old. And I have quite vivid memories of what before I was four. And it isn't that I haven't forgotten things, but that I have remembered things, more things than people usually do. And in my old age, there's an additional vividness to them, and detail. And the detail is sometimes so astonishing that I feel everything is there. Everything that ever happened to me is there. It's a matter of unhooking it and bringing it out to the light.
Are you saying that your past has become more vivid to you as you've gotten older?
Yes, much more vivid.
Is there anything that would explain that?
I think it's a common phenomenon. But also, there's, say I'm 86, there's a breakdown in the sense of the divisions of time between past, present, and future. The future is problematical, and the present is rather meditative because I'm not involved in an active job. And I read and wander around the house and garden and do things that don't interfere with any kind of meditative process. So there's nothing to prevent the accidental memory from getting into your mind. And I do think memories are attached. Something brings them up. They don't usually force their way up like air through water. But I have had a sense of that the past is no longer different from the present. That I can live in the past as I live in the present. I think. Some part of my life that I enjoyed very much, and I think, well, enjoy it. It's still here. You're in it, even though the people I haven't seen for 30 years.
Some people really say that people who they've loved who have passed are still with them in a way that they never expected. Do you ever feel that way?
Spooks, you mean?
Well, I don't mean like actual ghosts, but just feeling somebody's presence.
Yes. It's people often speak of it, really, and they speak of it as if they don't entirely rule out the possibility of ghosts. I think there's another way that people are kept. And that is someone who's especially dear to you, so dear that you can't face the idea of never seeing them again. You take on certain of their qualities. My mother was a very outgoing, hospitable, and quite happy woman. And I'm rather introverted and tend to be shy with strangers and like to be alone, like to read. And when she died, I was only a little boy, and I wasn't ready to give her up. And I haven't given her up. I think about her quite often. As I'm older, I remember her face more vividly. But I also am aware that that I have a kind of sociable life. I don't say that it isn't me, but it's a part of me that developed because I took part of her into my nature rather than let her die.
It was a long time ago that she died. It was 1918 or 19.
Immense time ago.
Yeah. You've written about her a lot.
Yes.
So you think you became more sociable?
I think so. Happy with people. Because she was always happy with people.
Losing her when you were, I think it was 10 years old, to the flu epidemic, it must have made you think that at any moment someone who you love could just suddenly disappear. Because people were dying all around during that epidemic. I mean, so many yes. Americans died. Were you always like bracing for that?
After that?
Mm-hmm.
No. My father was a very strong character and a physically strong man. And once when I was a little boy, I was in a boat on the Illinois River with my father and mother. And he was fishing and we were far out in the middle of the river and a sudden thunderstorm came up. And there were white caps on the waves. And it was quite a way back to the dock. And my father said to get down the bottom of the boat. And my mother was a heavy woman, so he had to pull quite a lot to get her in a hurry through the water. However, we stepped out of the boat just as the cloudburst came down. As long as he lived, and I think I have it still, the feeling of being safe because of him, safe because he was an honest man, safe because he was a decent man, and safe because he was physically strong. So what the effect my mother's death had on me was really that things happen that you don't want to happen, that you can't bear to have happen, and that you must somehow learn that there is no way to get around that fact. So I learned to live with the things that can't be undone.
From 1936 to 1975, you were a fiction editor at the New Yorker magazine. And since we're talking so much about memory, maybe you could remember for us a little bit what it was like to be at the New Yorker back in 1936.
It was a wonderful place. I was hired to see artists. That was the technical name for it. And there, at the moment, didn't seem to be any office space, so they put me in a bullpen in a corner facing a drawing on the wall by Thurber of himself. But it was outside Mrs. White's office, and so I heard quite a lot that went on in the office, and she was a rather stately woman, very handsome and very stately, and when private matters were being discussed, she would get up from her desk in a stately fashion and walk to the doorstop and release it, and then between the time it took a rather slow door to close, I heard quite a lot. Anyway, she hired me, and Catherine White and Evie White and Wilkie Gibbs and Ross and Thurber, all half a generation older than I was. And I never felt that I was responsible for the making of the magazine. But I admired them. I also had reservations because I was already a novelist when I got there. And I read enormously. And I saw that there were certain areas they were unwilling to touch.
Like what?
Well, it was astonishing now. They've long since got over that inhibition, but they wouldn't publish a story that involved the Jewish question. They wouldn't involve a story that involved homosexuality. There were several things that they felt simply inappropriate, which was formed a kind of straitjacket. Eventually, of course, everything and every kind of language has crept into the New Yorker, but this is the way it was when I went to work there.
As a fiction editor at the New Yorker, was it your responsibility to carry out certain parameters of discretion, you know, to respect certain parameters of discretion, so to speak, that you didn't really respect yourself?
I didn't have to carry them out. I just had to submit to them. For example, there was a John Cheever story which had the sentence in it, Coverley, with love in his heart and lust in his trousers, walked across the lawn. And the editor at that time, William Shawn, said it couldn't be published. I thought it could be published. I didn't see why it couldn't be published. I thought it was a wonderful sentence, but it didn't get published.
Shawn won.
Shawn won.
Of course, I suppose.
Yes. Yes. He had all the cards, but I think Wright was on my side.
So what was that exchange with Shawn like? Were you in his office talking with him? Was this a back and forth on paper that happened?
It was in his office. He put it in on a when the manuscript came back, he said it should be cut. So I went to his office to explain didn't think it should be cut. And I thought it was a good sentence. So he said it shouldn't, and I said it should stay in the story. And he said it shouldn't. So I just gave up and walked out of the office. What more could I do? I knew him well enough to know he wasn't going to change his mind.
And what did Cheever have to say about it?
I think I told John and apologized, but that's all that... he had many grievances against the New Yorker, but that doesn't seem to have been one of them.
We're listening to a 1995 interview with the late writer and editor William Maxwell. He's the subject of the new book, My Mentor, by Alec Wilkinson. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1995 interview with the late writer and editor William Maxwell. He's the subject of Alec Wilkinson's new book, My Mentor. I think of how much the world has changed since you were a boy, from, you know, horse and buggies to, you know, moonwalks and portable computers and all of that. Do you feel like you still make an effort to keep up with all the big changes, technological and otherwise, or is it not important to you now?
I don't say I make an effort not to keep up, but I certainly don't make any effort to keep up. For example, I use a typewriter, not a computer.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Mitchell, my colleague at the New Yorker, is fond of a Quaker phrase, which is very convenient. When there's something, some current manifestation, he says, it doesn't speak to my condition. And if you're 86, of course, lots of contemporary things don't speak to your condition. Your condition is placed 30, 40, 50, 60 years earlier. I liked the world I came into as a child. My father liked new things. He thought all the new inventions were marvelous. And in general, I've tended to hate them. I would so gladly put an end to all flying machines, all automobiles, all mechanical means of locomotion except the horse and buggy. It was a beautiful world. I loved the sound of a horse clop, cloppity, clop, clop going past the house. It was unhurried. It left time for brooding and thought. It left time for being nice to other people. It left time for making presents instead of buying them. It left time for telling stories.
The late writer and New Yorker magazine fiction editor William Maxwell, recorded in 1995, 5 years before his death. In the new book, My Mentor, Alec Wilkinson writes about his relationship with William Maxwell. Wilkinson has written for The New Yorker since 1980. They met when Wilkinson was a child, and his father and Maxwell were best friends. Wilkinson dedicated three of his books to Maxwell. Wilkinson was included in one of Maxwell's dedications, and Maxwell wrote the introduction to Wilkinson's book, Midnights. I spoke with Alec Wilkinson in 2000, just after William Maxwell's death. I asked him to describe Maxwell's writing.
He was a terrific, elegant stylist, immensely succinct, extremely complicated construction to his novels and stories, but all done to appear as if no effort had been expended at all. Only the most careful reader would be aware of the intricate architecture and the work that had been done to lay a word upon word as if he were building a stone wall. But he's a meticulous craftsman, a writer's writer. He was very fond of a remark that had been made, by a writer named John Hall Wheelock. I'm roughly paraphrasing, that writing involves the imposition of a line of words on a line of feeling. And I think more than any other writer I can think of, the emotional core of Maxwell's work is always paramount and profound.
Maxwell was a longtime fiction editor at The New Yorker, and among the many illustrious writers he edited were J.D. Salinger, Vladimir Nabokov, John Updike. Tell us a little bit about his reputation as an editor.
There was no one better. He was the great fiction editor of the middle and late period of the 20th century. But he was, as remarkable as his stature as an editor is, I think he's a much better writer. He was able to be such an acute editor, I think partly out of a great generosity of spirit. He was never, unlike any editor I've ever otherwise known, except perhaps William Shawn, he never appeared threatened by another writer's work. He never felt an obligation to impose his own taste upon another writer's work. He delighted in varieties of style, and even though he was a complicated stylist himself, the difference in style, for instance, from John Updike to Salinger to Frank O'Connor, another one of Maxwell's great writers, and to Nabokov is as broad a range as I can think of the period in English.
He worked with you on some of your writing, and yeah. You say that he would take his scissors and cut up your sentences and rearrange them and paste them back together. Tell us more about this method and what you got out of it.
Well, he surely never worked with a writer less developed whose work was in more of a raw state than mine was, simply because I didn't start writing till I was 24. I was a rock and roll musician before that, and I just had this idea to start doing this, and so there was a lot to clean up. It was like you had bought a piece of property that on which no one had cut the grass or attended to the shrubs for a long time, and you just had to get out there and clean things up. So he would really do that. I remember in my first book, I had a scene, a fairly long chapter, with part of which was a monologue involving one character, and then there was it was followed by a scene involving two characters, one of them the one who had spoken the monologue, and he took out the scissors and glue and combined the two scenes so that into something that was quite comical, because you now had one man going on in a rather sort of gassy monologue being interrupted constantly by somebody in the background who was having a kind of antagonistic conversation with him. And it was that sort of thing that began to make me aware of, I'm sure plenty of other editors might have read the same chapter and kind of thrown up their hands and thought it was hopeless. But Bill would really, and on that particular day, we had sentences all over the desk, and I kept sort of shifting them around. I remember his losing patience with me and saying, if you think this is a game, it isn't. Put those sentences down. But we just, that was as radical a piece of editorial intervention as I ever saw him engage in. But it was what I think a writer valued and depended on and leaned on Maxwell for was his judgment. And I always felt that if I showed something to Bill and he read it and found it passable, then there was no other judgment I cared for above that. No one I knew was capable of either greater penetration or greater certainty or greater estimation of what value, if any, something I had contained. And I've heard this from all of the writers whose names you mentioned earlier have also more or less, we all seem to be in agreement about the benefit of his company, his counsel, his estimation of your work.
Now, I believe William Maxwell worked with you more as a friend than as a professional paid editor.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Well, yeah, Maxwell was my father's closest friend. And when I started writing, I knew one of Bill's daughters, Brookie. I actually knew them both, Kate and Brookie, but it happened to be that I saw Brookie at one point and she knew that I was writing and asked her father if he would look at what I had done. And at the same time, my father had also said to Bill, would you take a look at this? And he had already left. I got to the New Yorker in 1980. Bill retired from the New Yorker in, I think, 1976. So we never actually worked together through anything but love, really.
Alec Wilkinson is the author of the new book, My Mentor, A Young Man's Friendship with William Maxwell. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.